What I'd like to do is just start and read out of this book here called The Heart of the Healer. It's a compilation of short articles by a number of people in the healing professions, doctors, chiropractors, various unorthodox healers, nurses, dealing primarily with their own feelings about the nature of healing, the nature of their relationship with patients, clients, whatever they want to call them, and particularly the heart aspect of that relationship and how significant each of the writers feels it is. By chance, I found myself involved with a small group of people in this country that chose to distribute this book. And by further chance, discovered that one of the contributors to it was the doctor in Mexico who treated me. And by even further chance, I found that my case history was included in his article. So I thought I'd first just read the case history to give you the context, and then we'll tell the story. Here we are, case number 3. White male, aged 53. That was a year off, by the way. I was 52 at the time. It gets important to that. In September 1986, he began to suffer from indigestion, excess gas, alarming loss of weight, and later severe pain in his right hip. He was studied and found to have a very large liver, a right pulmonary nodule, and a lesion in the lumbar spine. A liver biopsy disclosed a very aggressive metastatic adenocarcinoma, and a bone scan detected metastasis in his fifth lumbar vertebrae. The final diagnosis was primary carcinoma of the right lung, with massive metastases to the liver and to the fifth lumbar vertebrae. He soon became bedridden with excruciating pain and started to deteriorate rapidly. Nothing was offered him, being so terminally ill. He was admitted to Hospital Del Mar on November 26, 1986, for final care. Hospital Del Mar was the hospital in Mexico that I went to. Medically speaking, he could not live more than 4 to 6 weeks. It was rather shocking when I first actually read that, even though I knew it. But the patient and his wife expressed the desire to fight and the faith that he could still survive longer. Encouraged by such a positive attitude, we started to treat him. Moderate doses of radiation therapy were given to the lumbar spine. A special catheter was inserted in the umbilical vein to administer Laetrol and some chemotherapy, 5-FU, directly into the liver, and nothing was done to the lung. To our great surprise, the pain subsided completely after the second week, and the patient started to improve in a dramatic way. By Christmas, he was ambulatory. The liver scan showed definite regression of the metastases, and the CEA tests went down. He started to eat well and gain weight. On April 30th, 1987, a new liver scan showed 75% regression of the metastases, and the chest X-ray showed no tumor in the right lung. At the present time, the patient is in excellent clinical condition, and we've started to believe that, as incredible as it might seem, he could go into complete remission. Well, as of last December 88, I seem to be in complete remission. Touch wood, stay there for another 20 or 30 years. You want to say anything before we move beyond that? So, the name of the day is, what is it?
The Power of Caring.
Power of Caring. So I want to talk largely about the relationship that developed between my wife and I during the course of this, because she became, for me, the primary carer. I was given this diagnosis. We live in Gloucestershire. I went to my local GP with these rather ill-defined complaints, and was rushed off to a London specialist who put me in hospital, ran me through the whole gamut of things, including my shock and horror, 2 needle biopsies in my liver, which I hadn't been psychologically in any way prepared for, told that there were malignant tumors in the liver, in the lung. They actually, in London, weren't even aware of the tumor on the spine. And I believe the pain and the difficulty I was having there was simply a disc problem that had been rather chronic. It turned out that the disc problem was 1 or 2 vertebrae further down, and this was a tumor. But that didn't get discovered till we got to Mexico. In any case, I was offered rather reluctantly by the London consultant some chemotherapy, and that was his words. I said, well, what are the odds that it will work? And he very apologetically hemmed and hawed a bit and said, well, maybe 50-50. Didn't leave me with a lot of confidence or hope that there was anything much he could do. So not wanting to give up, I decided to look further. And went through some pretty intense emotional trips, I suppose is the only way to put it, during those first few days. And spoke to Anna a great deal about my feelings. And you were marvelous about comforting me and sort of helping me to focus on what I really wanted to do. Anytime you wanted to burst in here, do.
Okay. Well, I could come in here. No. Can you hear us at the back there? Should we speak up a bit more? Because
yeah, that's the machine.
Yes. Okay.
If you could shut the window, please.
The primary thing that I realized when we knew that Don was sick, without knowing quite how sick, was that whatever method he chose for healing, he needed support with it. He needed to trust himself that he had a clue what was going on, what was going to be best for him. And we talked a great deal about what we might do. We had some prior experience because we'd met Dr. Contreras at a conference about 5 years previously, and we really loved his approach, the holistic approach that he took when he spoke about his treatment. And we'd both been involved in alternative health care for some time, I suppose me particularly. So I had some background in healing and involvement with people in a less traditional medical approach. So we talked about the possibility of going to see Dr. Contreras in Mexico, and we also realized we should move pretty fast, not waste too much time dithering about it. So when we could find someone to look after our house and affairs, we got there as fast as we could, which I think was an important part of it, because when we speak to people now, there are a lot of people who ring us up and having heard of Don's experience, and want to know what to do. And all we can do is tell them about our experience. But I've noticed that people really take a long time to follow their hearts in a way. They leave it till the last possible minute very often before they'll be willing to treat themselves or accept some form of treatment. And I know with Don, I'd realized he was getting progressively iller over a period of years, nothing very dramatic, but periods of ill health and pain and discomfort. But he actually wasn't all that keen to go and consult anyone, to talk to a doctor about it. And in a sense, when we got the diagnosis of what was wrong with him, it made a great deal of sense to me. And I realized that he'd been in a lot of denial. He was in there was a lot of fear, a lot of grief, and it seemed absolutely natural to allow him and myself to express all the grief that we felt, to perhaps release, to unlock some of this heavy stuff that he'd been carrying around for a long time. So we spent a great deal of time, well, not a great deal of time, but a fair amount of time, having a good cry about it, didn't we? Mm-hmm. And talking about things in our relationship which hadn't been easy. We were in a crisis point in our relationship at that time, and considering a separation or divorce. And I think all of these things had added to the gnawing self-doubt that Don was feeling and unable to express, because he was, you know, brought up in a certain way, and grown men don't cry and they don't give in to he actually didn't know how to articulate a lot of things except for anger, mainly. So when he was able to express some grief and sadness, I thought this was a great step forward, because it began to allow something to flow and we could be more honest together, and also give each other some mutual support. And when you decided to go to see Dr. Contreras after talking to one or two other friends who had had experience through family members with the clinic there, I mean, it was a great relief, and I hoped you wouldn't change your mind. And although you did come back with some forwards, you always stayed on that course, in a sense. And I felt it was really important to just empower you, to trust you, that you knew what you needed to do, and encourage those around you not to confuse you by giving you lots of too many other ideas, so that, well, you were the one that was ill, so you were therefore the one who could heal yourself and take the steps that you needed with the right care and people. You actually knew what to do to get yourself better. But I learnt then the power of trusting yourself, and that you can, with the right support around you, you can heal. And it was very useful to me, having had that experience, because I felt if I could come through what to me was an extreme crisis, I felt that Don could, given the right circumstances, and if he was allowed to choose what he needed to do.
Well, yes, I think that one thing that I've come away from this entire experience with is a deep conviction that the psychological come spiritual side of serious illness, and particularly in my case cancer, is far, far more important than is usually credited. It's not just causally, but in terms of the cure. I realized along the way that the cancer, whatever a cancer actually is, seems to, or probably arises for a whole variety of reasons. Some of them are genetic. A lot of them have to do with the environment. I was a heavy smoker for many years. I think this whole area of the way we relate to the world, the way we interact or participate in the world, has a tremendous amount to do not only with the switching on of that oncogene, if there really is such a thing as an oncogene, but also with the ability to switch it back off again. I'm convinced, and this flies in the face of most of accepted wisdom, that cancer doesn't just go into remission, but that it can actually be cured. That the cure is a function of psychology, and something larger than the usual boundaries of psychology, at least the boundaries that are pretty well agreed by most professionals in the field. That's the crux of my experience. The medical intervention was obviously important. It bought me time. It certainly got me out of the most excruciating pain. The problem of the fifth lumbar vertebrae left me with dreadful sciatica in both legs, and it was about as hideous a pain as I could imagine. And 10 sessions of radiotherapy, about 300 rads, I think, was the total dose, wiped that tumor out, and suddenly I was out of pain, and thus much more able to cope with what I felt I needed to do to turn the more life-threatening, the more specifically life-threatening tumors around, which were the liver tumors. We'd forgot about the lung, but in that case history, when they discovered that the lung tumor had disappeared, it was really quite funny, because I was sent in for my chest x-ray, and they took it, and I went and had a look at it on the light box, and I said, "Where's my tumor?" And they all looked and frowned and mumbled to each other in Spanish and made me go back and take another x-ray. And we looked at the second one, which was exposed a little bit better, and still wasn't there. So we all laughed uproariously, and they sent me on my way. And been untreated specifically, although the 5-FU that was put into my liver was, of course, coursing through the rest of me, so it must well have got to the lungs, amongst other places.
Could you say something about the change you felt within you? It seemed the crucial bit was, from what your wife was saying also, this decision that you were going to go away, you found a path that you were going to follow.
Yes.
Can you say something about how you felt about it? Does this gradually grow, and then what did you feel when you said, right, I'm off to see this bloke?
Well, the initial thing, I spoke to one or two close friends who were involved with I suppose spiritual teachings. And they each said to me exactly the same thing, which annoyed the hell out of me. And that was, you've got to become more radiant. Now, I'd been interested in that sort of approach to life for a long time, and I thought I was pretty radiant. And they kept treating it as if, no, you're not. You've got to really transform yourself. And I said, but how? You know, this is a ridiculous thing to lay on someone like me who's miserable and suffering and about to die. But that was all they could really say. And it stayed with me, that one had to do something that would transform one's own consciousness. And I knew the rightness of it, I just didn't know how or whether it was even possible at that stage. When the idea of traveling all the way to Mexico to an unknown clinic, although we'd met the doctor at this conference very briefly and had been impressed with his talk, I had no idea what we'd be getting into. The thing, actually doing something different, breaking free from the ordinary rut that I'd quite obviously been stuck in for at least a couple of years. After that, when I got through the worst part of the pain crisis, I was able to begin to think much more deeply about my own situation, about my own psyche, my own purpose in the world. A lot of this thinking was done in conversation between the two of us. We were in an unusual situation in that at the hospital, most of the nurses could speak very little or no English. The doctors were all totally fluent, and we spoke next to no Spanish, so we were fairly isolated and thus thrown back upon each other a great deal of the time when treatment wasn't in process. And we were able to do a lot of work, I think probably to our mutual benefit, not just to... There was something, I suppose it had to do with becoming increasingly free-flowing, able to actually participate in something that was invisible, unknown, and absolutely uncertain, and to enjoy that participation, not to fight it or feel insecure or to be feel trapped. I was terribly frightened of dying. The fear of death was quite overpowering for a long while, and when it became clear to me that it looked highly likely that I wouldn't live more than a few more weeks, something said, you've got to do something. You've got to clear up some unfinished business, tie off some loose ends. And then I realized in the course of that that I had a lot of unfinished business with my two grown children who live in California, and with my father who also lived in California. So we arranged, or Anna, I asked Anna to arrange for them to come and visit. And she organized that so they would come at different times so that I could speak to each one individual. My two children and my first wife tend to travel together as something of a pack. They're always together. So Anna had to sort of take one and get them out for a cup of coffee and get another one, just get them all separated so I could talk to one at a time. And each one of them, I spent time alone with, and my father, the two children, and with my ex-wife, and basically found that what I needed to do was just express love for them. The children had grown up largely without me. I knew there was a great deal of residual resentment of them for me. I didn't want to die and leave them with that, with no way that they could clear it. So I was quite specific with each of them, discussing the idea that if there is any resentment, if there is any deep-seated pain, you know, let's deal with it right here and now and get it out into the open so that we can say we love one another and say goodbye. And to some extent we did that. I mean, I think I satisfied myself. I don't know that they were able to open up as much as I would have liked. But at the end of this cycle, it was over a couple of days with between my father and the kids, I suddenly felt terrifically relaxed. And for the first time, I realized that if I was going to die, it was all right. The fear pretty well vanished. And I wasn't in a state where I was now accepting and prepared to die and wanting to die in any sense. But it was all right whichever way it went. It was just a sudden relaxation overcame me. And I was really, for the first time, in this participatory mode, I suppose, participation with this greater unseen cycle. And it was a lovely state to be in, although the pain was still there and I was still too weak to do much of anything. And I don't know for certain, but I felt that somewhere about that time is when things started to turn, when the aggressive carcinomas suddenly decided to stop being so aggressive, whether they actually started receding in size at that stage, I don't know, but it must have been around then.
I was thinking of something the gentleman here asked, and it seemed to me that, and I asked you much later about it, but when you had decided on what course of treatment you were going to take and actually began participating in the choices available and the people around you, you regained a sort of sense of adventure. And I think that was very important for him. He wasn't just, taking it. He was actually really participating in an adventurous way. And we also, because we'd been reading some books by Bernie Siegel and the Simonton, there's a book called Love, Medicine and Miracles, which was very useful to us. So we did some painting. I had some paints along with me. So you started drawing. When you were fit enough to sit up, you began to draw your condition and your situation, and then that was interesting to talk about, and also you could modify it along the way. You could change it when you saw yourself in a sort of rather apathetic sort of situation. You could see what was going on and consciously do something different about that and draw a different picture, as it were, create a new future for yourself.
Yeah, the pictures were very valuable, painting. I mean, it was like a child, because I'm not much of a draftsman. But I was making these childlike pictures of my cancer, of the chemotherapy, curing it, or dealing with it. also doing these visualization exercises, of finding a way to visualize the cancer cells and visualize the my immune system attacking it and eating it up and carrying it away, that sort of thing. All of that, I think, was hugely valuable. Very difficult at first, because I discovered that it was a tremendous effort to lie there in pain and close my eyes and come up with these visualizations. And I was supposed to do them, according to the book, at least 3 times a day. And often, again, I was very fortunate that Anna would make me do it. I mean, she would come in and ask, have you done your visualizations? And I would say, well, no, I don't really, maybe I'll do them later.
But I used to read them to you.
Well, you did for a bit, yes. And you would read the guided meditations.
Yes.
That was a bit different.
Yes, and then give you space for your
I think that was all hugely useful. A bit later, I met a man who was a hypnotherapist, a psychotherapist, hypnotherapist, who worked with me a little bit on another aspect of it, which I think was very important. And that involved, before I met the hypnotherapist, there were times when I was quite keen on fighting this thing, on doing battle with the tumors, what I saw at that stage as an alien invader in my body. And then there were other times when I would just get so fed up, the pain was so much, I'd be tired. I'd want to just curl up, turn my face to the wall, and say, to hell with the whole thing, I'm ready to die. And at times like that, I felt, my image of it was like there was this overgrown infant who was terribly selfish, who didn't want me to live, and was quite happy to kill me. And I worked with this image a lot and couldn't get rid of it. I mean, I thought of all the normal psychotherapeutic things, I mean, the child within me, the shadow, all of these ideas, and tried to work with it, and we worked together with it, but this big overgrown infant wouldn't go away. And then when I met this hypnotherapist, I told him about it. And he explained something to me that I hadn't realized. He said that these periods that you're in fact judging and evaluating as negative aren't necessarily so. And he pointed out that fairly recently they'd found that there are cycles of sort of up and down in all of us that range over about 90 minutes. He said a 90-minute, call it outward, or I hate to use the word extrovert because that means something, but 90 minutes of extroversion, 90 minutes of introversion is a very normal cycle. And within that, if one is ill or injured, one will go into an added cycle or an added period of inwardness. Much like an animal that's wounded will go off and be alone and curl up in a corner somewhere and lick its wounds. He pointed out that was an absolutely essential part of the healing process. And rather than try to fight off this giant infant that I'd conjured, to accept it, to let it work with it, and to realize that was an equally important healing process as my concentrated will and my repeating sort of silent mantra like total remission, no less. I repeat that to myself a dozen times a day. And once I was able finally to relax with that, and the whole process then became much less of a fight or less of a battle. Then again, back to this idea of participating in something that was unfolding all the time and that was creative and fascinating and finally, in a strange way, enjoyable. I also psychologically realized from my reading and introspection that, I mean, all illness has some meaning. I mean, it all has some value to the patient. And I began to make a list of the, you know, why did I have cancer? What was I gaining from it? And I made this list, and I could make Anna pay attention to me in ways that I didn't seem to be able to make her pay attention to me when I was healthy, and various things of that nature. I can't remember the list now, but there were about 8 or 9 things I came up with that made the illness valuable. Then I realized that the idea of a terminal illness wasn't valuable at all. So I looked at each of those points and realized, okay, you've done that. You've accomplished each of these ends. So it's okay, it's all right for the illness to go away now. And I concentrated on that as an image too. That it had done its job, it had got me what I'd wanted, and now I had to do something quite different, otherwise I was going to die. And again, in having shared this with the hypnotherapist, that entered into the two rather lengthy sessions I had with him and helped to reinforce and make that new shift in my own psychology work. I don't think I'll use that strategy again to get anything that I wanted. They're far, far more effective ways.
Somehow we let all our normal sort of driven things fall away, and well, you said moved into a flow, and it was sort of a yielding to a sort of another pattern, another rhythm, which was much more heart-oriented.
Ask a question at that point, just before you go away from. You were saying that the system of the hospital and Don as a member of the team and yourself as a member of the team was very rewarding in that sense. But I was getting the impression that it was all one-way traffic, that you were giving a lot to Don, a lot to the system. A lot. What were you actually gaining from it? Those were Don's gains. What about yours?
Validation, in a sense that I had some understanding what was going on, that I was probably the closest person to Don, and what he couldn't say and express for himself, I was able to do. And also, I had certain ideas about how to look after someone who was ill. I'd been involved in attunement work, in healing, for a long time, and this was obviously much more close up. I had to put my money where my mouth was.
Right. Right.
And I was given the space to do that. I mean, I was validating the ideas that we had and the experience that we had. And, well, our life experience in general was accepted and worked with. What did I gain out of this? In retrospect, I'd say I gained a lot of self-confidence. In my own abilities, but also in my perceptions, and that the intuitive mode of perceiving is very valid, and that actually that, you know, a lot of people said to me afterwards, gosh, it must have been a terrible time for you, awful, how, da, 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 da. And actually, I can't say it was. It was an adventure. It was strenuous at times. It was very challenging, and it was very, very interesting. And, I mean, sometimes I think, heck, that was my husband who was my guinea pig in a sense. Not my guinea pig, but the fact that, you know, there couldn't have been, other than my son, anyone closer, that I had some degree of responsibility for their welfare and well-being. And that the thoughts and training that I'd received over the years worked.
Say you use the word heart orientated quite a lot. What do you mean by that? You mean emotionally orientated, or what do you actually mean? How would you define it?
Yeah. Well, I think emotions certainly come into it, but a sort of acceptance of deep feelings without judgment, just a very natural way of being. I mean, not rejecting anything of, you know, intelligent, intellectual approach, but that there is another intelligence that can be understood and expressed through a loving atmosphere. And what I mean, what you and I might be understanding of each other now, I don't think I'm speaking in particularly medical or intellectual language, but I'm sure you understand what I'm saying and what Don's been saying, so that this mode of being is valid. And I think we have underestimated it in our Western approach.
I mean, can I just add one bit to that before? There was also this quality of real caring that came from doctors, from nurses, from everyone involved. I mean, they were not remaining aloof to protect their own emotional realm from the pain and the possible failure in their terms. But they were quite keen to open themselves to a relationship with me as a patient and to all the other patients there. And it was that question of relationship. It became very much a family. Every time I have to go back there once a year to for checkups, just so they can keep tabs on me now. And it's really like coming home when I go there. They're my family, all of these people. We see the doctors and we all hug one another and find out what's been going on in the past year. And there was that real concern, something that I've never experienced either in medical treatment, conventional medical treatment in this country, and certainly not in the States, where the doctors are friendly. I mean, one might even know one of them socially, but there isn't that, all I can say, that very warm heart Latin kind of relationship. And that involvement, I think, was crucial to what I consider to be the success of this particular story. Sorry, is that?
I think you just answered my question, actually. My question was going to be, the doctors took you into their confidence. They told you everything that they were doing. Unlike this country, where the doctors go behind a screen and talk about you, and you don't know what's going on. And that gave you a lot of ease and helped a lot, that you knew everything that was going on. That took a lot of stress away.
Yes. There were times when I had to be actually quite careful, because they would suggest a course of action. And I would question it. I would say, but why? The moment I'd say that, they would immediately be willing to back off and say, oh, well, if you don't want to do that, maybe we'll do something else. And I'd have to say, no. All I want to know is why. I'm not telling you we shouldn't do it. But they were so willing to cooperate and to make certain that I was being treated in a way that I was happy with and that I understood everything that was going on. Before I had the surgical implantation of the catheter, I sat and I watched a 25-minute video of the actual operation, with the surgeon pointing out every step of the way and showing me the fluoroscopic things of how it worked once it was installed. And it was fascinating. I'd never been keen to watch a color close-up of someone's guts wide open and knives and rubber gloves being poked around in someone's belly. But it was fascinating to know that the next day I would, having chosen to do it, would allow that to happen.
That relates to my question. Can I just pick up on you seeing a video of an operation that you were going to have, and Anna saying that people were very honest and open, and in that honesty and openness must have been distressing news sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I certainly find that often in hospitals they say the patient shouldn't know that sort of thing. When it comes to communication, maybe that should still be filtered or monitored. Was it important for you to hear the bad stuff as well as should it have been censored?
We hadn't actually asked. When we left England, Don was given a 50-50 chance with some chemotherapy, perhaps, something like that, wasn't it? But the general prognosis was so depressing that we packed up and did something else, went to Tijuana. And when we were there, after a few days, and I realized that Don had these things, this unfinished business with his family and some emotional conflict and turmoil about it. I knew he was deeply uncomfortable and worried about dying and things. And we actually hadn't ever asked the big question. So when I was on my own with one of the doctors one day, I said, I think I need to know, how long does Don have to live? Remember, this, what I'm saying is without treatment. This is if he received no further treatment, he'd have 4 to 6 weeks. But we obviously expect the treatment to work or assist. And I obviously expected the treatment to be of value, or we wouldn't have been turned on to. But at that point, I realized I now knew I had some privileged information. And what was I going to do with it? Was I going to keep it to myself and try and carry on caring for Don and making things as easy as possible for him, keeping this secret? And I thought, no, he really needs to know, because if... And he needs to know, but I have to be able to tell him in a very gentle way, mm-hmm. and a very a realistic but a optimistic mm-hmm. sort of way.